I'm going to talk to you now on a further extension of games and processes which are immediately germane to processing on a games level. It's almost as if the processes we are using today were all games processes of one kind or another, because certainly they do compartment under the heading and category of games. And it would not be out of order to call the procedure which we're using today game standard procedure or something of that sort. The facts of life are best viewed by you from the viewpoint of a game, since a game at this level of existence here in the mid-20th century of the sixth year of Dianetics, were you aware of that, by the way, that this is 6 A.D. after Dianetics? anyway, the facts of the case are that we view a game as having the elements in it, which are so-and-so-and-so-and-so. And in truth, we should discover as much exhilaration and excitement in playing the wider game called life. And so it's very easy for us to view this highly specialized thing called a game, like an exciting game of football or cards or something of the sort, and say, well, now that's what we're trying to process too. But it is this atmosphere which best characterizes life well lived. It has all of the elements. Interest. Well, we find a great deal of fault with some particular who can't get interested in anything, and yet we see that in games we have to have a high interest level. And in life in general, then, we also have to have a high interest level, don't we? And we take a look at penalties, and we find that a game is not possible to play unless there are some penalties for failure, and thereby you can establish the win-lose category, you see. It's very necessary to establish what is winningness and what is losingness. And we do that by giving losingness certain penalties, and winningness is supposed to get certain freedoms. Now, that's basically the way it works out, but in actual practice, winningness and losingness are alike, no game conditions. What do they do with the great football player? They send him out to sell insurance. They even take the playing field away from him. After he's played football for a while, he no longer has a game. He's too good. There has been a time in the field of boxing when a champion has arisen who could get no contestant. Such a person way back when was a fellow named Joe Louis. And for a while, it was very difficult to get anybody to step into the ring with Joe Louis, because somebody'd step into the ring, Joe Louis would haul back, sock once, and that was the end of the contest. And getting a contest with him was being knocked out for a price. And Joe Louis was thereby in a no-game condition. In other words, he's being denied the ring, denied the audience, and so forth all the time when he could not get a contest. He was too good. All right. Very much better than that. Think of the luckless general who, from some misguided stupidity, manages to conquer all of the world. Who is left as an opposing player in this game called war? There is no opposing player, and so he is really in a no-game condition. There's a chap right now named Franco, who, by the way, is conducting a much better administration than the rest of the Western world would actually give him credit for. I mean, Spain is being hung back together again and so forth, because Franco himself is practically no longer a participant. He is in a no-game condition. Various things have happened to him, which are quite amazing. He's almost retired. He looks about as close to no-game as you can look, you know. And just Spanish officials in general and so forth are going on governing Spain, just as though there hadn't been much of a revolution. There are an awful lot of police around, but people just try not to be noticed by them and do what they please. The Spanish philosophy of how to be a good citizen. Now, where we see many other points, we get this parallelism between livingness and gamingness, and we can view livingness synthetically, you might say, by viewing actually games. All right. Another factor is this, let's come back to it again, interest level. Did you ever realize that a person in apathy might still be interested? That's right. I've never seen such a grueling apathy in my life and seen such interest in it as I have through the middle sections of the United States, out through what they call the Bible Belt. What delight is taken in this apathy. It's wonderful to behold. You wouldn't consider, for instance, that anger was a delightful mood, but a fellow who is angry is interested. So we find this whole emotional scale, one way or the other, does have a common denominator, this ephemeral thing we call interest. And having this there as interest, which a Thetan defines as whether or not he cares to put his attention on it, or cares to take his attention away and put it back on it again, we have the emotional scale, and so we get the mood of game, which we can use as a technical phrase, the mood of game. Now, this game mood, which is easily established, does not deny interest, but it does say at what level of the tone scale. And by this, we can take clear from Hyde up to No and Serenity on the old ARC scale and its sub-zero extension. And we can take this in its entirety and say that each and every one of these is a mood of game. So that we have the fellow who plays football. He's interested in playing football, and he is always angry when he plays football. There's the fellow who is a fine polo player, and he's very interested in playing polo. And distinctly, he is, oddly enough, bored. You look at him, and he just couldn't possibly be anything else but bored, but he does go on playing polo, you see. This air of boredom with which he plays polo is, of course, an insouciance which he injects into the atmosphere of his opposing players, which drives them mad. It's a wonderful pose, you see. The nonchalance with which he will knock through a goal is, and yawn about the whole thing and so on. They're willing to kill him before he gets through. Now, of course, we err and actually end games when we insist they must always be played with enthusiasm. Because enthusiasm is an artificial mechanism, but it's still on the tone scale. But enthusiasm is not really interest. If you wish to countercheck this, I invite you to an experiment with an e-meter. You take an e-meter and you put somebody on the e-meter and ask them what they think about anger and watch the needle and what they think about this and what they think about that. Once you've got them nicely settled into the meter, the use of an e-meter is something that an auditor ought to have, because at any moment you really may find some need of an e-meter. They are very useful, and it's one of the tools an auditor should have, and it's one of the things he should handle. And here we find that if we then ask the individual, what do you think about enthusiasm? He gets what we call a theta bop on the E-meter. It's a little flop and tick on the needle. It's an odd little characteristic. The needle goes over, and you ask him about enthusiasm, you get this tick on the needle of the E-meter. It's a very curious manifestation. Well, you should say, now, what's this all about? That's because enthusiasm is the more widely accepted emotion with which one should play a game, and therefore you see it is a limitation and not a mood of game. And so therefore it's developed into a penalty. I can't play because I can't get enthusiastic. You get the idea? We have cheerleaders out there in front of the cheering section going rah-dee-da and throwing their megaphones up in the air and all that sort of thing. And they're insisting actually enforcing enthusiasm there. These people might be really enjoying themselves by being in grief, you see. Their side is losing, and they might be weeping about it and feel much better. It's a much more honest emotion, you see. So enthusiasm is an enforced jam of the entire tone scale. And enthusiasm very easily converts into apathy, and quite oddly enough, is a game penalty which hangs up on death as a supreme penalty, and so gives us a theta bop. In other words, the more you condense the scale by an enforced enthusiasm, you would eventually get some sort of a ridge. And this ridge would then convert, sooner or later, into something or other, and you do get the same manifestation as death, which is to say, it is simply another penalty. It becomes a penalty. In other words, the fellow who is playing the game of Undertaker in life, now let's be a little broader about this thing, is enforcedly beautifully sad. You know, he must always be beautifully sad. Now, if he's enforcedly beautifully sad forever, you know, years and years and years and years, you'll find him sooner or later developing a theta bop. Not because he's an Undertaker, but because he has been frozen on the tone scale. Now, we look around and discover if we became a holy man out in India, we would undoubtedly be expected to be serene, and we would become enforcedly serene, and just as dead as a mackerel emotionally, and not serene at all. Every once in a while, by the way, a preclear will run across some past life. I'm sorry, but they're very much with us. We find that this preclear has been perhaps a holy man, a monk or a hermit or something of the sort, and is, during that period, enforcedly serene. And this horrible serenity will cut in, you know, and the fellow will go around saying, all I can be is this horribly serene feeling. And he complains about it. Now, people complain about any point on the tone scale that they are forced to assume. So we merely have power of choice on the mood of game. And when the power of choice has been overcome and the mood has been enforced, we then get a stuck position on the tone scale. Actually, an individual who is in good shape should be able to assume any mood of game or should respond to any mood of game without keeling over. Now, each one of these emotional points, each one of the points on the emotional scale has an intention, a clear-cut intention behind it. Each one of them actually says exactly what it wants to have happen by reason of emotional emanation. A person emanates a certain emotion, and this emotion is the concrete or energy, you might say, substitute for a postulated intention. As he goes down the scale, he makes different postulates toward the opposing side, you see. And these then become kind of solid and in energy. And he goes along grammatizing them. And at last, when he can no longer go forward toward the opposing side, he still is playing the game when he lies down and cries, you see. He hopes the other side will now cry. He's setting the example. So below 2.0, it becomes imitative magic. Now, wherever we look on the tone scale, we discover then that each is backed by a postulate originally intended for an advantage of play. And we get the mood of game as one of the more tricky activities in games themselves. We get the individual using enthusiasm, you see, in the hopes that his own team will carry on. All right, that's fine, but enthusiasm might get contagious to the other side. So enthusiasm is an upper scale introverted emotion. It isn't quite as outflowing as you think because it's mainly directed at your own side, not directed toward the enemy. Follow? So we get these introversions and extroversions overlapping and succeeding each other as we go down scale. Now, where the individual then is owning. You see, we have a lower harmonic of enthusiasm. Do you see that? Do you see that apathy, for instance, could be a lower harmonic of enthusiasm, too? And ownership, the mood of game has become solid, that's all. But the mood of game is hardly translated at all. It is simply an owned situation. But you'll find that ownership does have an emotional value. It's so unemotional that it's very difficult to actually sense it, but it is there. All right, so all the way up and down this tone scale, we have the entire category of mood of game. Now, one of the great difficulties which your preclear will have in trying to grasp this is his preconception of mood of game. How do you play mama? I don't know. You go around being scared of everything. See, that's how you play mama. That's the mood of game. Mama's in a fixed fear of some sort. Let us say that. Or let's say mama is in a fixed serenity. How do you go around playing mama? You just ignore everybody and everything, particularly children. You get the idea. Now, if you look at this, mood of game in the preclear is how do you play X game? How do you play what game? Follow me? All right. As we look over the general activity of the individual, we find then that mood of play can become a penalty, a fixation. There's a fixedness. So that the individual is made to believe that in order to play a game, he must have a certain tone. Now, we take an artist, let us say. Here's a wonderful example of this. We take an artist, and this artist is always painting, but he knows how he has to feel to paint. See, he's known another artist or way back when. He's been around art an awful lot, and he knows what mood he has to be in to paint. He has to be in a mood which we will peg as a certain savageness. You see? There's a certain savageness that he has to feel and assume before he can stab that paint on that canvas. Of course, he could have gotten this in other ways. Critics early in his career could have mistakenly said to him, there is so much force involved in this thing. Well, his painting is done with antagonism. You get it? So, how do you paint? You feel antagonistic. And one fine day, because he's also playing the game of girlfriend, also playing the game of old soldier, or he's playing a number of other games, and naturally always in past and barbaric times was playing the game of internal revenue or income tax or something of the sort. In other words, he had various games he was playing, and each one of these actually required a different mood. You don't go in and see internal revenue with any antagonism. The accepted mood of game, you see, accepted mood of game is palpitating terror. And the proper approach to the portals of is to be dragged in quiveringly across the threshold, you see, with people supporting you on both sides because you're fainting before the awful majesty of it. So this chap becomes unsuccessful in life because he can't shift to mood of game required by the game he's playing. He's painting all the time, so he has to be antagonistic. He becomes fixedly antagonistic. And he becomes fixedly antagonistic, and he starts getting antagonistic to internal revenue, you know, inland revenue. That won't do. They fix him. And they teach him not to be antagonistic. And then he can't paint. You see how neat it is. It's actually, it's very often we make a mistake by saying something is simpler than it is, but it's actually just that simple. He tries to use the mood of one game in another game where it is not suitable. and Soar loses the mood of his main game, which he considers necessary to that game. The truth of the matter is that a painter paints best if he can paint with the full range of emotional responses in himself. That is to say, if he can paint apathetically, and he can paint serenely, and he can paint angrily, and so on. And as long as he doesn't think he has to be fanned out all over the tone scale in order to paint, which is the other one. He has to be able to do all of these things or he can't paint. That would be another limiting postulate. He runs into the penalty section. So in processing, we discover that we have a specific range of problems. There are three elements in games, which are, of course, freedom, separateness, and addingness, and problems. All right, the three elements. Now we have to subdivide these three elements. You say, oh, no, we had it all nicely simple, and now we're going to subdivide, and we're going to get 89 characteristics under each. 89, the devil. We'll probably have several thousand subdivisions to each one of our simple parts. Get through. All right, we look under problems, and we discover that there are several categories of problems, and the whole point is which one of these categories is important. Well, we have known for many years that the emotional scale was the important band in all processing. It was very important. You shift somebody's emotional tone, you've really done something. What are these fixed tones in which we find him? They are simply moods of game that he has considered very, very necessary and is currently considering necessary. And therefore, if we shift his mood, we're liable to take the game away from him, so he's not going to shift on the tone scale. There's the answer right there why they don't change easily on the tone scale. Fixed mood, and they don't dare change. And we see under problems then, problems being very necessary to the playment of any game, you see. We find under problems that there are some other little items that come in. Whereas mood of game is simply a part of the game, it can very easily slide in under problems. Can it? And it itself can become a problem in the playing of the game. And so as we look under problems, we discover that the problem of mood, assumption of, falls right straight down to another specialized problem, which is penalty. Follow me? So penalty and mood of game can both be headed under problems, can't they? Well, I'll tell you something else quite interesting. Emotion has mass. Emotion has mass. It very definitely does. One makes the postulate, and then to enforce it one way or the other, he's liable to use all sorts of things. For instance, I don't think you would be upset if you considered that a bullet had a certain emotion. It definitely does. It's usually mad. So emotion and mass can become very easily associated, the one with the other, and we move in under havingness with mood of game. It's quite neat, isn't it? Move in under havingness with mood of game. And because people, as I said, get shot and bopped and pushed around, and because there's the field and so forth, and the loss of field, we then have penalties can come in under havingness, too. Well, how about freedom? Yes, I'm afraid that freedom to have a mood of game and freedom from penalties are also quite important. So that if we take these three things, problems, havingness, and freedom, and omit one of them from the game, we cease to have a game. We cease to have a game to just that degree, leaving only two portions, whichever two remain. And these two portions, of course, are inadequate to conduct a full game. They're inadequate to engage Thetan's interest, actually. So as we look at these three elements, we discover that each one of them is equally divisible by some things. Now, we've gotten two things which divide each one of these elements up. And one of them was the cycle of action, which is, of course, create, survive, destroy, which is really create, change, survive, change, destroy. The three main points are unchanging points, and there's change points right between the two. It's actually 5 points on the scale. And that is germane to freedom, and that is also germane to problems, and it's also germane to havingness, isn't it? So if we drew these three things up, problems, freedom, and havingness, we'd do a cross line through them, and that would be the create, change, survive, change, destroy, remembering that the three main points are unchanged points. You can run change, unchange, you know. You always run them orderly. You don't just run them one at a time. Then we could have three more bars there. I mean, through problems, freedom, and havingness, we could draw three more lines very nicely, one through each, all of which would be the same line, and they would have mood of play and penalty. See? Because penalties could be you're going to get more problems than you bargained for. That could be penalties. Eh? And you're going to have or possess problems. See? That could be a penalty. And the other one is you're going to lose your freedom, you see, as a penalty. And we would have at once penalties occurring under freedom. Completely aside from havingness. It may not be at once apparent to people in this day and time, but havingness is not necessarily trappingness. One is not necessarily trapped by havingness. So that a penalty subdivides under freedom and havingness. See, we've got a penalty under each. And we also have mood of play under each, because freeing somebody up on the tone scale and yet having mass in the emotions themselves puts mood of play both under freedom and havingness, doesn't it? And there are innumerable problems posed by the postulates and interplay of the mood of game. And so it comes under problems too, doesn't it? And somebody might lose all of his problems, and that, of course, would be a supreme penalty, and that would be the end of problems in general. So we could have loss of or gain of on mood of play or penalties under each one of these three categories. You see what we're constructing here? We're constructing an interesting little diagram which gives us, by its interlockings, an almost infinite number of processes which very fortunately are sufficiently powerful to undo a great many things. Now, if you just ran problems, the fellow would sooner or later run into mood of play and penalties. See, if you just ran problems, I'm not talking about processing in the direction of games, you see, because there isn't any other direction of process. You just have some chap run problems, and sooner or later he's going to run into mood of game. He's also going to run into penalties. If you process havingness, he's going to run into mood of game and penalties. That's a cinch. He's sooner or later going to get an engram coming up with a bullet knocking him off or something of this sort in it. There's going to be mass as a consequence at once to the mood of game and the penalties. All right, and let's look at freedom, and let's discover under the heading of freedom that we have mood of play and penalties also categorized in terms of freedom. All right, so this is a nice, interesting little interlock. Well, if we're doing this much about games, how about games themselves? Why not just process games? Well, why not just process problems then? A fellow is going to run into freedom and he's going to run into havingness, and he's going to run into all these other elements. Why not just process just problems? Well, it's because by processing an element too high in this logical scheme, your preclear misses it. He misses the cognitions necessary to an improvement of his case. You're actually evaluating for him if you say problems and then run him on problems, and eventually, he just isn't cognizing at all, and he never comes up with mood of play, so on. He never comes up with penalties. He doesn't cognize on it. Every problem he gives you is a penalty. That's fascinating. He gives you no other problems but penalties, and he never cognizes on this. Because we have overreached our preclear, and we have to undercut, to a very marked degree, the processes involved. Therefore, we at least have to add into this processing scheme, we have to add penalties and mood of game. And unless we process them somewhat under the other three headings, why, the preclear never grasps the lower level of reality necessary to a continuance of his case. And it's necessary that you start him somewhere on a reality and then make it more real from there on out. You see, that's necessary in the case. So therefore, we have to have a certain number of subdivisions as we go down in order to get him up into it. Now, I tell you, one of these tricks, which is fascinating, is to run lying and invention as the two lower levels of creativeness. And lying is a very, very low level. That's an undercut. Just above that, we have invention, and just above that, we have usually actual creation. All right. Nevertheless, these two are low levels of creation, and as such, then do give the preclear chance. Now, we get him so that he can tell a lie. And you know, by the way, we occasionally run into a preclear and we say, all right, now tell me a lie. I mean, just let's be crude. See? It's about as low as you can get. You say to this fellow, tell me a lie, and he'll just sit there and look at you. Can't. Just calm leg. I never had a preclear do other than calm leg about this. I mean, I've never had this process be too high for him. But I expect at any time to run into one. And we've actually started him out at a level of invention, you see, and creation. When we ask him, tell us a lie. He'll sit there for an hour or two, and then he'll finally say, well, I'm wearing a white coat. Looking at you very covertly to see if you're going to kick him in the teeth or something. And he discovers that you haven't kicked him in the teeth, and he feels much better. And from there on, he can tell you lots of lies. He can tell lies about the environment and other things. All right. Now, when we get him so that he can lie, we have really increased his ability to invent. So now he can invent things. And when he can invent things smoothly, why, we can move him upstairs into a much more creative level on this. Of course, invent, theoretically, by its own definition, should go all the way, but it really doesn't. You have to tell him, start creating things. Creation, to him, means spaces and masses, ordinarily. Or it means a logical thought pattern of some sort or another, which is probably, when you first start processing, too complex. So we have to get him freed up on this create matter. And similarly, we'll sooner or later have to get from him what he's willing to let survive. It's quite interesting. We run into that very thoroughly if we run such a process as repair. What could you repair? What wouldn't you mind repairing something like this? Ugh, it's likely to be an awfully rough process, but it's terrifically low. It actually undercuts create, but it's over on the survive side. Furthermore, destroy and separateness are the lowest scale there. Is what could you push away from you slightly? Walks right on up to what could you eat alive? It would be handled to get rid of, to dispose to its own detriment, sort of thing, and so forth. There's a very low process in this. What would you be able to be critical about? It's just about the lowest level of destroy that you could enter in on. What could you be critical of? That's actually a destructive action, isn't it? You'll find preclears who can't be critical of anything. And they, of course, can't destroy anything, and they get an engram up in front of them, and it's it. It's saying it. That's it. That's that. Now, survival is this business of remain. We have these three actions. The actions of mocking it up and pushing it in and mocking it up and letting it remain and mocking it up and throwing it away. Well, that's just under havingness. They're comparable processes under problems. And we say, all right, now what problem could you have if we did something on that order? We could then say, what problem could you let remain unsolved? And then what problem could you jolly well bash in the head? And we have the create, survive, destroy, and the havingness cycle, both at once being parallel here under the same process. Now, there's a less observed one, simply because it's a little higher scaled one, but is nevertheless quite germane to the game and has to be processed sooner or later, but isn't processed early in the case, and that's the whole subject of freedom. Freedom is simply freedom by postulate. It isn't freedom in space or from anything, you see. It's just freedom. And just plain separateness might sooner or later get a fellow up to the level of ultimate freedom. And in a fairly good case it would, but some other cases liable to have to be boosted sooner or later, or punched a bit on this subject of freedom. And the odd part of it is, it will uniformly be punched on the opposite side of the bracket. You know what a bracket is? That's an old-time term. That's, you have him run the postulate for himself, and then run it as though somebody else is making it, and then somebody is running for somebody else. You know, and somebody else run it for him, and him run it for somebody else. There's five ways in a bracket. Well, anyway, a old bracket, you'll find he's on a bracket of freedom, negative. That's the usual precursor you run into, freedom, negative. And if you were asking this question, what would you set free? He's liable to give you, nothing. Not his own freedom. His own freedom here is not in question. It's just somebody else's freedom. We ask him, we have to. His own freedom is so unobserved by him that he probably could sit in the middle of a concrete block and not be able to wiggle a theta toe and consider himself free as a bird. I've had prisoners in jail tell me that they were free to do what they pleased and come and go. They were crazy. Nevertheless, you see, the question is what would he free? And that is usually the entrance point there. What would he free? What would he permit to go free? And we have a lot of trouble in this society with the question of exteriorization, so that you really don't talk very broadly about exteriorization. People, they find it out, actually, processing is so designed these days that exteriorization takes place. That's all. It just takes place. Period. The fellow tells you about it, and you say, that's fine. You go on processing him, and he's liable to yo-yo around and do other things and so on, and eventually stabilize. But the less attention you pay to exteriorization, the better off you are these days, because in the majority of cases you run into, it'll lock up and key in a past death. So you don't pay too much attention to exteriorization. You certainly do acknowledge it, though, and you certainly do talk about it, and you certainly do discuss it when the preclear says, you know, I think that's my body right there in front of me. What am I doing here? What am I, you know, if I'm not a body? So, let him talk. Talk back to him and get real interested and, be right there. Because if you were to neglect this and not acknowledge it, you're liable to throw him into a deeper apathy, and he's been in for a long time. But don't work with it as such, and immediately just let him straighten out. He will. He will. Almost any low-level process that you're running can be continued as the person exteriorizes. For instance, you're asking him what body he'd like to have and remedying his havingness with it. Well, he's been stuffing it up to the point of exteriorization into his body, and now he exteriorizes in some fashion. Why, you just have him... He said, well, where do I put it, or do I put it in the body, or something like that? Or you notice he keeps on putting it in the body. Well, that's rather dull. If he asks you about it and you have to do any direction about it, why have him push it into himself? See, that'd be the only choice. Himself while exteriorized. But that's a permissive thing. You needn't even guide it particularly. Well, that's the way you handle exteriorization. And the reason you handle exteriorization this way is because people cannot confront freedom. It's a very funny thing. Revolutionaries running all up and down the place saying, libertad, equalidad, and cabbage. and comes to revolution, you like cabbage. Or some other revolutionary motto or war cry. These chaps are talking a lot about freedom, aren't they? And freedom has become, as you saw immediately, you have to, in order to run penalties and mood of game under the heading of freedom on most preclears, you would have to say freedom from, wouldn't you, in order to undercut it sufficiently. So that freedom has now become freedom from. And people never look at what they're escaping to. You know, the fellow who flies straight away from the elephant and backs right into the tiger's jaws has nothing on the fellow who follows these revolutionary banners with their regular claptrap. The only way man ever got anywhere was by evolutionary processes, by knowing where he was going and then going. He doesn't suddenly get someplace by this game of let's chew everybody up. Now, the revolution, then, is actually quite antipathetic to the better good of man. But it is in itself a game, and it just as a game. And it happens to have employed this thing called freedom all too often. And people, I've actually gotten to the point where to let somebody else free or let anything free is almost impossible. And I'll give you an example of this. A young girl, quite batty in one of the old foundations, and quite batty, she sat there gripping her purse to her bosom. And the auditor unfortunately asked her to hand over her purse or put it down or something of the sort. He couldn't see this preclear sitting there gripping this huge purse, all during processing and so on, and he almost ruined her. That was the end of that. See? We had to get another auditor. It was too much of an auditing question. What? Give up something? Outflow something? Oh, no. Well, now from that level, we go up to a point of where a fellow would throw away a dirty Kleenex or something. And, you know, not have any real regrets, not remember it until midnight. Of course, at midnight, start worrying about it. Well, there, you see, he's moved over more toward havingness than toward freedom. And his concept of freedom is that if he let anything free, he wouldn't have. And that is the usual misrationale on which he travels. Some individual, by the way, married, he keeps his wife in too tight, you see, too restricted, something like that. And first thing you know, he hasn't got a wife. In other words, he sets up the compulsive, do a bunk sort of take freedom by restricting lines and actions, you see. In other words, he sets up the separating mechanism by closing the distances too tightly. And he's doing that with his body all the time, and you really wouldn't notice that. He's so afraid of the body going out of control that he will not get any distance from the body. Now, if you think that a preclear is in terrible, horrible, awful, and rotten condition, and that is that because he can't get out of that body, you're on the long line of thought. He's in rotten condition because he won't let that body get out of him. You got it? Now, that's the right line of thought. Now, he'll give you a lot of kidding around about this, and he'll mess you up, but the key phrase on exteriorization and that which results most uniformly exteriorization is control. Control, start, stop, and change, in other words, of motion. And the individual has a feeling he cannot control the body from outside it. And therefore, he dare not let it go free because he would not be able to guide it in any way. And he's actually pulling one. It's just another game. When it dies, I'll be stuck in it or something like that. He's scaring himself. No preclear ever lived that didn't blow one way or the other when the thing was no longer animate. In the first place, it's almost impossible for a thetan to get stuck in anything. You see, there's something with no mass that is somehow or other sticking to mass. He does that with a mystery sandwich. There's the thetan, you see, and there's a slab of mystery, and there's another terminal. See? So we got two pieces of bread with a mystery spread between it. And the mystery spread keeps the two pieces of bread together. And that's about the way it works. Now, As we look over the entire problem of auditing, then, we discover that it is a gradual restoration of freedom and a reassertion of the balance between freedom and no freedom, the balance between having and not having, the balance between problems and no problems. And there is a game level. And one of the ways the preclear finds out that he's again in the game is he is again free on the tone scale. So his mood of game is rehabilitated. It's reestablished, you see. So he has his mood of game at his own choice again. He can assume other emotional states than fixed boredom or deep apathy or grief or something of the sort. And therefore, he's quite happy about this thing. But remember that we could alter, just as we could alter the mood of game to some degree by processing havingness, by processing problems, and processing freedom. See, either any one of them processed would to some degree alter this mood of game. So we could process penalties under these three headings and again alter the preclear and make him feel better. And we could still process one of these three points, havingness, problems, or freedom, to the exclusion of the other two and come a complete flop. Fascinating. We could do this. We could process freedom, 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 freedom. You'd have a sick preclear on your hands after a while. Gone too far with this. He didn't enter in on his game. For instance, spotting spots in space is kind of a freedom process, you see. And won't wind up anywhere. Most preclears, some preclears are on a lower inversion, by the way. They spot spots in space and with perfect equanimity and get sick at their stomachs when you try to remedy their havingness. I mean, that ought to be the reverse. They're on a reversal. Those preclears, wildly enough, come up to a point of where they get sick, spotting spots in space, and feel better on a remedy of havingness. Quite amusing. So we process freedom, we process problems, we process havingness. We have, to some degree, an equilibrium. Well, then it's up to us to look over and see, well, then when and where is the person most stuck? Well, actually, you may think he's usually stuck on destruction or something like this. If he's stuck in destruction, it's rather covert. Actually, they're stuck in survival. The body's very stuck on survival. And you've got a create, survive, destroy curve, which is jammed right tight. It's very, very, very tightly identified. There's create is destroy, and survive is create, and it's all messed up, and it's entanglement. He isn't able to make much sense out of life or anything else. He's just in a jam, you might say. All right, now, the generality of existence is that you have to separate this by making him create and actually survive and actually destroy, at least be willing to. All right, then where is the human race stuck? Where is the human race stuck, really? If it's stuck anyplace, where is it stuck? Well, horribly enough, it's stuck not on the tone scale. Those chaps that you can get onto the tone scale and process go right on up with old-time Dianetics and Scientology. The people who were unprocessable, and who are processable today rather easily, there aren't any real rough cases these days. Of course, you can say all cases are complicated and all cases are tough. This would be a true thing to say. All cases are complicated, all cases are tough, all cases have their oddities. But to say somebody's unprocessable today, I'd just say the auditor wasn't feeling well. There's always ways to undercut these people. There's three processes for find the auditor, you know. You can always undercut them. Look at me, who am I, is the simplest one. Walk up an auditor. What kind of an auditor could you have? Those are the three auditing questions which fit under find the auditor. They're actual auditing questions. You get some amusing answers, too, and find out why the pre-clear never got into session. You can always handle the pre-clear, but where is the race stuck? Well, they're stuck in penalties. That's where they're stuck. They're so thoroughly stuck in penalties, they're convincing themselves that they're still being penalized under the heading of havingness. How do you get havingness? By penalizing yourself, you know? Well, just look at it. The only big buildings which you see around any place that are well-groomed are, I omit the pubs and bars and nightclubs, are the banks. And just how a currency, which by definition flows, can get stuck that thoroughly in marble portals and make all that mass is certainly a comment on the way currency's being handled. It's being handled in exact reverse to do this trick. So we look and find these very affluent, there are some banks in the United States much fancier than government buildings. I mean, they're really pretty good. Anyway, we look over, the latest and biggest building built in Washington is the Federal Reserve Bank, and everybody thinks that's a U.S. institution, which it isn't. It's a private bank. Which the U.S. uses, just like you and I may use another bank. It's under charter. So, and when we get a stuckness and a huge mass of this character, well, what are they doing? They must be doing something that's in pretty solid agreement with society to get all that tension and havingness and so forth paid to them. Well, they certainly are. They are saying that if you save, you will have. This is real neat. I mean, it really took a giant brain to figure that one out. If you start saving things, you'll stop creating things, and you're done. That's the surest way to suicide, is to start saving. A writer who wants to rehabilitate his art if he's saved any money, throw it in the Thames. Dump it in the Hudson River. Got any furniture or anything? Throw it away. Wife's probably being unfaithful anyhow. Leave her. Go down and sit in Central Park with nothing but the clothes on your back for a while. You'll write. I mean, every writer saved all of this stuff up, you see, and he's got there for his old age, and he started to be careful, you see, and the next thing you know, he can't create. Why am I using a writer? I guess it's because I've known so many of the beasts and processed so many of them. But actually, there, not for that reason. It's because creation is visible. Now, less so the bank cashier. He starts saving. You say, well, there's nothing else for this chap. He's working there. Job. The only thing he can do is save money and retire, and he's over. Where the hell do you get the idea anybody's going to retire in his old age? He's working for a bank. They're in it for themselves. He'll probably get fired at 26 years of service if they have a contract to retire him at 30. Some of them even fire him a week before they're supposed to retire. Anyhow, what the dickens is this all about? What kind of a philosophy is this? It's a control philosophy. A heavy control philosophy. It's trying to get an individual to penalize himself in some fashion. Best way to penalize yourself is start believing everything is scarce and that you better save it. The bank cashier, what's he doing, a bank cashier? You know, every once in a while I hear some father say to his son, you know, well, I worked and slaved and so forth and finally sent you through school, bought you nice clothes and set you on your way, and here I am, old and gray. You know, the only answer to that is, why the hell didn't you make more money? I'm afraid that's not very sun-like, but really it's the truth. Papa was making a game out of not creating in some fashion. Now, if you think the money is the end of the effort, you're making a bad mistake there too, because it actually is merely a representation of your creativeness. That's all it is. It merely represents it in some fashion. And if your creativeness is good, you don't have to worry about saving any money. Your best investment is your own skill and your ability to put things back together again, your ability to stand on 2 feet and live. That's your best investment in the world. And some fellow grind away in some little brass cage endlessly and forever and aye, you know, getting hunchbacked and caved in and completely sour on figures because he's saving money. You know? Actually, they've destroyed him by this mechanism. You see this? Well, he's so willing to put a penalty on himself that it's easy to give him the philosophy of save money and so forth. If I put myself inside this restriction, then I'll be able to have this other game save money, you see? Fascinating. Well, that's how you get big banks. But you every once in a while run into a pre-clear, and you process them up, and they go home, and they feel good, and they come back the next time you see them, and they feel terrible. This pre-clear will tell you, well, I always invalidate myself. I always, you know, I say I'm feeling good, and then all of a sudden I realize I'm not feeling good. The pre-clear has no other players in the world. You got that? The pre-clear is handing out wins and penalties to himself. And he's trying to keep a balance between win and lose over an anxiety about the game in general. And you make them better, and they'll make themselves worse. Sometimes you make them worse, and they'll make themselves better. Same game. But out of this whole system, we merely have this one point show up very generally, is there are no other players to this player, and we must rehabilitate then the existence of other life forms. We have motivators and sacrifices and so forth to get an individual finally to accept live forms. There are many processes by which it could be done, all of them rather successful. But if you orient your processing against the reasonability of playing a game and with the idea that you are playing a game with elements that don't want your pre-clear to play a game, you get some fashion like this, some game going, and if you carefully avoid the idea that you and your pre-clear are two players in the same game. Many auditors think this, you know. They think that the pre-clear is another player, and they'll give him loses, 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 and so on. It's fascinating. It's just a misconception of their part on who they're playing this game with. Now, I'm not telling you who you're playing this game with. You can play the game of auditing with the darndest categories of people you ever saw. As a matter of fact, we can play this game of auditing with some of the darndest, biggest, roughest players you ever walked into. I mean, we got an unlimited opposite side, and we also have unlimited allies and team, you see? Both potentials are very, very high, but the pre-clear is under the misconception that he is another player with you in some kind of a game sometimes. Well, don't you ever get under that misconception. You're going to help this guy out in spite of him. That's the way it is most of the time. You've got to get him into a mood where he can play a game. And auditing is putting people into a condition where they can play, and at the same time playing one of the biggest games on the part of the auditor there is. But if he identifies himself so much with pre-clears, as such, if he has a scarcity of pre-clears and starts saving pre-clears, he will become a pre-clear. And he will have this misconcept with regard to the role of the pre-clear in his own role, and so will give the pre-clear loses, and so won't be success in auditing. However, none of you will ever do that. Well, now, in playing a game and in living, you see many parallels, you see many elements. And you can just sort of look at these elements as you're processing the pre-clear. And no matter what process you're running, you will process much more intelligently and understandingly. And you can keep this whole thing in balance with the pre-clear very, very easily. You can see where he's missing and where he's falling down. You can see what he has erroneously chosen for his fellow players in life and what his fixed moods are. It becomes a very, very fascinating thing when it's understood through this frame of reference. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you.